Between 1990 and 2005, a new prison opened in the United States every 10 days. Prison growth made imprisonment so profitable that millions of dollars were spent lobbying state legislators to keep expanding the use of mass incarceration to respond to just about any problem. Today, we have the highest rate of incarceration in the world. So says Brian Stevenson in Just Mercy, A Story of Justice and Redemption. What is the current status of mass incarceration in Wisconsin and the United States? And how could different perspectives from the UW's School of Human Ecology help us understand this pressing social problem in new ways? I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air. Joining me today to explore mass incarceration are four guests. Mary Beth Collins has a law degree and directs the Centers of Excellence at the UW School of Human Ecology. With her are three PhD students in the School of Human Ecology, Joy Huntington from Design Studies, Cynthia Burnson from the Department of Human Development and Family Studies, and Ethan Pollard from Civil Society and Community Studies. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
This is a new way to approach a problem for me, which is to take one subject, mass incarceration, and then to come at it from the point of view of different departments all working in the School of Human Ecology. Mary Beth, can you start by giving us some kind of overview about the choice of this subject, mass incarceration, and why it's worth coming at in this different way?
Certainly. Well, at the School of Human Ecology, we pride ourselves on being able to look at grand challenges in our society and understanding the way that the full human ecology, families, communities, individuals, are impacted by things and what solutions might work to address such problems. And recently, actually, in our school, there have been a lot of discussions around the issue of mass incarceration because we know it's an issue that is pretty specific to the U.S. context, quite different than other places in the world. And we know it has deep and long-lasting impacts for individuals, families, and communities. And so in the context of our community and nonprofit studies program, in our human development and family studies department, and in other areas of study at our school, there have been research projects and presentations on this topic. And so it's top of mind for those of us at SOHI. And I thought it would be interesting to explore it with some of our fabulous graduate students.
And could you give us, just before we turn to, you know, one of those background areas, design, could you give us a little sense, Mary Beth, of the problem? You know, how bad is it? Brian Stevenson certainly says that we have the highest rate of incarceration in the world. That's quite an indictment. But what does that look like, and including here in Wisconsin?
Certainly. Well, as a starting point, the United States has less than 5% of the global population, but incarcerates about 25% of the total number of incarcerated individuals on the planet.
That is shocking.
Yes, yeah. Indeed. And in fact, the next most prominent country in incarcerating people at high levels is way below us, and our numbers are drastically greater than other countries that feature in the top five. So from a human ecology perspective, I think this really demands of us as Americans to examine what that means for us as a nation. Of course, recently there's been an increased focus on this phenomenon. We know that there has been legislation put before the Senate on addressing mandatory minimums, which are a feature of the truth in sentencing movement that came about in the 80s and 90s in response largely to hard drug crime in the U.S., but has resulted in an explosion of incarceration for especially long sentences for nonviolent crimes. From 1980 to 2008, the U.S. prison population quadrupled from 500,000 to 2.3 million people. That means that one in 32 adults at any given time is incarcerated in our country. We also know that there is a huge spotlight right now, as it should be, on the way that different communities and populations in our country are affected by this phenomenon. African Americans are incarcerated at six times the rate of white Americans. And the impact on those communities for the long term is just really cannot be understated.
Yes, I see that all the time with my UW Odyssey project that I direct, because pretty much every African American student in the class has someone they know that is incarcerated, or they've been so themselves, and in a disproportionate way that makes Wisconsin one of the worst in the country, I think, in terms of locking up black men disproportionately. Anything else that we need to know before we turn to the concept of design and prison?
I think I would be remiss not to help frame this a little bit in the context of Wisconsin, since we're big believers in the Wisconsin idea at SOHI, and it is relevant that here in our state, We have some of the worst disparities when it comes to the differences between white incarceration rates and African-American incarceration rates. And for the first time in our most recent biennial budget, corrections has surpassed higher education as a feature of categorical budget funding from general revenue. So this is very relevant in Wisconsin, and I think so he will be doing work on this in the near future for our state.
And I should say that when you say SOHE, that is the School of Human Ecology, that the lovely acronym SOHE. Joy, you're in design studies. Tell me what brought you into that field.
I actually used to work in social services. I worked for a nonprofit back in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania with young girls ages 8 to 18. And one of the things we did was in-home services, foster care, and I ran the after-school and summer program. And there were times when I went to pick up girls and I would see that in the group homes, the cabinets and the refrigerators locked with locks and chains. And then I would sometimes visit the therapy rooms that they would have therapy in, and it was not conducive to those situations. So I started looking at these spaces and seeing, why aren't they working? What is happening here, and how is it affecting the girls that are working there? And I did practice for a bit in Pittsburgh, and then I realized that I wanted to know more about that psychology of space.
And what specific area is your research focusing on?
I'm in environment and behavior studies, looking primarily at that, which is the study of a person in place and their connection and how it affects the behavior.
And wrapped into that, what kind of aspects of design would be included?
So that can include not just the built environment of brick and mortar buildings, but also landscape. And it does include the physical aspects. It includes temperature, sunlight, glare, color, materials, and even how the space is planned out and how you move through the space.
Well, I would think that, you know, as we apply that, as we'll do in a minute, to the prison system, that there are a lot of things to be thinking about. What would the role of a designer be then?
The role of the designer. So there's this debate, which I actually had recently with my advisor, on what are designers and how do we want to train designers now going forward too? And we want to see ourselves as problem solvers. So we solve problems that society has, and we try to fix the meet the needs that they have as well. So like in healthcare, there was a lot of problems there, and there's been a ton of research that designers have done to see how patients heal, not just physically but mentally and emotionally after any injury, surgeries, and things of that sort, sicknesses. But we also had to look at the doctors and the nurses and how did they do their job and how they worked in the space. So certain maybe colors and orientations and of where the windows were really played in part to that, so that when a doctor is either examining a patient in their room, the color of the wall behind them doesn't affect the color of the skin, which is a sign to nurses and doctors of how a patient's doing, or the design of an operating room.
Oh, so it's everything from sort of practical effects to right. Also the sort of emotional effect that it might have on someone.
Correct.
So if we take a look at the whole area of prisons, how does the aspect of design come to play?
And this is where it really gets interesting, because we haven't done a ton of research in that area. But what we do know is that it hasn't been working. And some research has said that it's not working. Over in Western Europe, there's been great strides in trying to change how prisons are designed. Their philosophy might be also different from ours, where some of the leading architects who design prisons over there, their thought is, you know, having someone's freedom taken away is punishment enough. What we need to do, and then our spaces need to do, is support the rehabilitation of these people so they can successfully reenter society. And the debate here could be, I think, in the U.S. is, are these spaces designed as a punitive measure, or as are they designed to be rehabilitative? And as a designer, we deal with clients. So if our client, whoever is owning and operating the jail, hires me as an architect, in a lot of ways, I might adopt their philosophy so that I can keep my job.
Well, that's problematic then if there might be a need for reform.
Correct.
If we picture the standard supermax prison, either because we've seen one or seen a movie where it's there, it seems like the epitome of dehumanization. Can you give us some sense where, if you were to look at a supermax prison through the lens of design, what are some of the things you would see?
I would see the materials. I would probably see the surveillance and the layout and how that affects surveillance for the staff. I would also probably look at lighting and how people move through the space. So, and one of the other things, I would see if the space reflected anybody's thoughts, anybody's beliefs.
Or you mean if it was personalized?
Personalized, because these inmates, and not just the inmates, but the staff that works there, they are there for a long period of time. So they create this attachment to this place. And it's probably not a positive or healthy attachment to this place because it's not feeding them in a positive way, I would assume, because I know I wouldn't want to be there. And but to spend the inmates spending years in that space and staff, yes, they do get to go home, but in the same respect, they're in that space for 8 hours a day at least. So I would want to also look at what's happening psychologically to these people and what can we do, what can I do as a designer to try to minimize this negative impact where the attachment to the place, it may not ever be totally positive, but it could be less negatively impactful.
Well, especially if you want people to come out of that environment changed and have a better experience when they come out.
Yes.
We also think of the solitary confinement, where it's absolutely nothing, right, on the walls. And
right. And there's actually a great debate going on in the architect world. The AIA they have a member, Speary, who heads
up. And then let me back you up. So AIA is American something architecture?
Yes.
Just
it is the American
acronym.
Institute of Architects.
Okay.
Okay. And Speary, who heads up the Architects, Designers, Planners for Social Responsibility, they are looking to try to enact more stringent a code of ethics for architects because they don't want architects to design solitary confinement spaces because they feel as though it goes against the code of ethics of an architect and designer.
Well, that's interesting.
Yes.
Because you had mentioned before that architects work for a client.
Mm-hmm.
And if the client is the state and the state is demanding a certain thing, that takes away the architect's sort of personal ethical responsibility.
And Speary and his organization is looking to take a position much like the medical profession, where they have the do no harm. And because architects and many designers are licensed, if we adopt this idea, this part in with the code of ethics, maybe that is a way to start to make change.
That's interesting. I did read an article recently, I think in the New York Times, about a prison in Finland, if I remember right, or some Scandinavian country, where it was set in nature and there was light and there was not that sense of bars, and you know, it was just a very different kind of place. What if you looked at, you had alluded to this before, the difference between an American prison and some of the international ones, but what are some of the areas where international prisons look different?
One is some people say doesn't look like a prison. In some areas you'll actually have it within the city. So it matches the city's landscape and structure that is happening. So if you were to look at it, you would never notice that that is a prison. When you go in, some people may think, oh, it's so light and airy. There's light coming in. The materials are different. It's and also many of them are also looking at not having that big imposing cold structure, but more village-like too. So if they're outside of the city center, it's more like that countryside.
I'm imagining that there would be quite a few objections if that went forward here. You know, oh, you're coddling. You know, this isn't a hotel. Some people don't have it that good who haven't broken the law. So I'm guessing that there would be a pushback.
Right. Here. And I hope with possibly this push forth for reforming the punitive system that we began to also look at design as part of that solution as well. I know recently in San Diego, they built a facility that they used the research that in Western Europe they've used to design theirs, and also what has been done in healthcare research to try to make a more humane facility. And we shall see if that is going to work. But we don't know, because the research for how space impacts, that sort of space impacts inmates and staff, we don't know what that impact is. So we still have to do research to try to improve, just like we have done in healthcare. And I'm hoping we have that access to do that. And that's the other thing. We have to get access to these facilities, to the staff, to inmates, to find out what is really going on so that we can design better spaces. And the other flip side is the philosophy of our clients. So we have a battle going on. We have the clients, we have industry and our licensing organizations that we have to fight, in our own philosophies.
What do you see as some of the challenges that designers would face if they're designing prisons, besides the fact that they're maybe not free to do their own thing or follow their own ethics? But what are some of the other challenges?
I think where we're placing them as well.
In terms of being far away from the prisoner's family?
Yes, I think location is one of them. Because if you have the idea that I want to build a space which is going to successfully help this inmate transition back into society, they need that support system. And if they're a distance away from their support system, not just from family and friends that's going to help them transition, but also the community organizations that help as well. And if they're a distance from that, those relationships can't, one, be built or maintained.
It seems there's always something in the news, too, where somebody escapes either by going underground or on the roof with a helicopter or whatever. So I suppose there must be also a challenge of keeping a facility secure while also not making it seem like there's so much surveillance that you have no privacy at all.
That's correct. And I have to say, in a lot of ways, we've made definite strides, but we still have a long way to go. In the U.S., there's very regional design and how things, prison design is held. So in Texas would be very different than how prisons are designed up here, because we take on somewhat of the regional culture and that landscape, and we kind of add it. So we have to think more about where we're at, what works for our people, and the culture and the society and the region that you're designing that space for.
I've been talking to Joy Huntington about design and the question of mass incarceration. We are going to be looking at mass incarceration and its impact on families, and then later also on its impact on communities. Back in a moment with more of University of the Year.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with guests from the School of Human Ecology, and we are talking about the problem of mass incarceration. We were talking about design of prisons, and we're turning now to another area, and that has to do with child and family well-being. My guest in this part is Cynthia Burnson, a graduate student from the Department of Human Development and Family Studies. So tell me, Cynthia, what is important for us to know about families and the problem of mass incarceration, which Mary Beth Collins was telling us is such a huge problem in the United States? You know, we incarcerate more people than anywhere else in the world.
Absolutely. So we know that because we have so many individuals incarcerated in this country, of course, many of them are within the age range of prime childbearing years. And so the majority of incarcerated individuals have at least one or more minor children. So that means when you see these numbers about how many individuals are incarcerated in our country, we're looking at that same number or more of children who are affected.
Give us some sense of scope. How, like, if you're looking at the landscape of the United States, how many children and families and so on are affected by this problem?
Yes. What seems to be a straightforward question becomes a little complicated. There's estimates saying about 1.7 million children have a parent in prison. However, prisons and jails are different entities. Prisons are federally or state-run. They tend to be longer sentences. They tend to be farther away from the family's home. And they tend to have more severe crimes, so more felonies. Jails, on the other hand, are locally controlled facilities in the county generally. And the fact of the matter is we don't have good numbers about how many children are affected by a parent in jail. Their estimates range wildly, but we know that it's somewhere in the millions. Jails can be for individuals who have a short sentence, less than 1 year, for perhaps a misdemeanor. They can be waiting adjudication or transfer to another facility. And so we know that there are millions of children affected by incarcerated parents, although we don't have a very solid number on that.
I'm assuming that some of those children end up wards of the state if you've got a single parent or no family backup in terms of where that child goes.
Absolutely. And so what we know about children of incarcerated parents is that it's an incredibly heterogeneous group. And so it would depend a lot on who is the parent that is incarcerated. If it's a father incarcerated, for example, the mother is most likely the majority of the time remains the caregiver of that child. However, if it's the mother that becomes incarcerated, we know that the grandparents are the most likely caregiver. But then, as you said, a high proportion of foster care or other terminated parental rights, the father, other relatives, it can be a very complicated caregiving situation.
What does the research show in terms of the impact that a parent's incarceration can have on children?
Mm-hmm. So this is a relatively new area of research. Despite the fact that we know that from the policies of the 80s and 90s, that's when the incarceration rate really took off in this country, the research there's been a bit of a lag. And so it's only been in the last 10 to 15 years that we've really started to delve into these issues. So we know that children of incarcerated parents are at increased risk for academic difficulties, behavior problems, especially aggression, higher rates of truancy, and involvement in the criminal justice system as adults. However, there's a really important point to make on this issue, which is that the research is not clear whether there is a causal relationship between the incarceration of a parent and these issues in children. And so the other thing that we know about children of incarcerated parents is that if a child has an incarcerated parent, they are also so much more likely to be experiencing other risk factors, poverty, mm-hmm. family instability, exposure to family violence, and other traumatic events. And of course, from decades and decades of research, we know that those factors can lead to these child outcomes that I was speaking about. So academic difficulties, behavior problems, anxiety, and depression. So as researchers, we have not finally, definitively answered the question of, is there a causal effect of an incarcerated parent on a child's well-being? However, we know it's so intricately linked with these risk factors that these children really need our help, and these families really need some support. They, on average, are struggling, although there's huge variability.
It seems sometimes there's a vicious cycle where, let's say, father is in prison, and the mother raising children without that father present has less in the way of
help and resources and so on, the child has lost a role model and then perhaps goes into kind of a life of crime as well. But you're saying it's hard to tease out the cause and effect there because there's so many variables. What role does poverty play? I mean, if you remove the income differential and you look at, you know, what the outcomes are for children, what difference does it make if that family has economic resources?
Mm-hmm. That's a question we're still trying to answer. So we're looking at lots of different factors because we know that there's so much more going on than just having a parent in jail or prison. And so the short answer is we would expect that to exacerbate the situation greatly. Poverty is a huge threat and an adverse event for a child growing up. We know that from research in other areas. And so insofar as that is sort of associated with an incarceration, so for example, if, as you said, the incarcerated parent was providing economic resources to that family prior to the incarceration, and now those resources have been taken away, of course that would have a negative effect. But that's still an area of expanding research.
I would think it would be also important to somehow study self-esteem and the way that a child feels about the family based on that incarceration. Are there measures to do that?
Yes. And so one thing that's really important to think about in a human development and family studies perspective is that we look at children developmentally. And so, of course, the effects of this incarceration will probably vary by the age of the child when that parent is separated from them, in addition to what the quality of the relationship was like prior to the incarceration. So that's something really important to keep in mind. So, for example, a 2-year-old will have that separation. Of course, that is very difficult for a child of that age, a preschool-aged child, an infant. But they might not have the same sense of guilt or stigma. That might be something we see more in middle childhood through adolescence.
What I see quite often, obviously this is anecdotal, but what I see quite often in the children of incarcerated parents that I work with is anger, where, you know, the anger at having been abandoned, the anger at not having that parent there gets sometimes translated into what looks like violence toward others or just acting out. What kinds of work is being done on how to help a child who's in that situation?
Yes, absolutely. And so resources haven't really caught up with the problem in this area. And so there aren't a lot of, for example, programs directed through the schools just at children of incarcerated parents. There's a couple issues with that. One is that would require disclosure. And if mm-hmm. stigma is one of the issues that we're looking at with these children, then that would be a challenging intervention, you know, to sort of gather up all the children under that rubric has its own issues.
Yeah, they have that when they're working with homeless children as well.
Right.
There are programs in the school, but again, it's a problem of stigma.
Right, absolutely. One resource that's been developed recently with my advisor, Dr. Julie Palmentinen, she served as an expert advisor for Sesame Street. And they have put out a packet of materials aimed at the preschool age, approximately 2 to 6-year-olds. And it's available on their website, sesamestreet.org/incarceration. And what Sesame Workshop did is they looked at these numbers that are so staggering of how many children are affected by this issue. And they realized that they wanted to develop some materials to help caregivers, because one thing we come across a lot is social workers or caregivers, they don't know what to say. They don't know what to say to that child who's affected. They don't know how to explain where their parent is. Should they tell the truth? If not, what is the level mm-hmm. of detail they should be giving? It's a real, should they be bringing that child to visit or not? What should they do? And research is starting to uncover some of those answers. And so what Sesame Workshop did was they gathered a panel of child development and mental health experts, and they put together a multimedia packet with a DVD. They actually created a new Muppet named Alex, who has a father in prison. He sings a beautiful song, and he talks to his friends on Sesame Street about missing his dad, about the stigma that he's feeling. And they sit down and talk about it. Also in the multimedia packet, there's a storybook for the children. There's a few other shorts describing a visit to a jail or a prison to help prepare children for that experience. Because as we know from the design perspective, that entry can be really stressful for children. They have to take off their shoes. They need to go through a metal detector. They might have to get patted down. Perhaps the employees at the prison are less than friendly or welcoming. It might not be a welcoming space for children. And then it also has a tip sheet for caregivers, how to talk to your child about incarceration, what kind of language can you use. And we really recommend what we call sort of a developmentally appropriate but honest answer. So we might say something like, the parent has broken a grown-up rule called a law, and now they've had to go to jail or prison, which is kind of like a big timeout. These are the types of words that we would use with younger children. It also has some information for incarcerated parents on how they can retain that parenting role from prison or from jail. What kind of communication, letters, phone calls, how can they stay in contact? Because we know that that is incredibly important for the incarcerated individual to maintain those ties, if at all possible. It reduces recidivism rate. And the fact of the matter is that the vast majority of people who are in prison or in jail are going to be back in our society. So we need to think very carefully about how we're preparing them, how we're keeping them connected to the society so that when they come back in, they can be successful, they can be family members, and they can contribute.
Can you share a little bit about your own background and why you're interested in sort of family impact?
Sure. So when I came to graduate school, I'd been a preschool teacher for 7 or 8 years. And so my first sort of passion is child development. But as I came to study it through graduate school, I'm also equally passionate about social justice and well-being. And the topic of children with incarcerated parent just really brought the two together in a way that I just find very meaningful for me.
And if you could look into the future 10 years, what would you want to see happening that's not happening now?
I think that's an excellent question, because when we do what we call resilience research, which is which children are doing well, which children aren't, and sort of what's the difference, one thing that it's incredibly important to do is to zoom out for a moment and realize that the easiest way to boost resilience processes in children is to remove the threat. And so the threat to child development, the threat to positive child development. So having an incarcerated parent being an adverse effect on that child and that family, I would love to see that the incarceration rate drop precipitously. Because the best way to promote child development is to remove that threat in the first place. And on the one hand, we need to focus on the here and now. There are children and families struggling. They're suffering and they need support. They need to have this topic be brought out in the open. And I'm so glad that we're doing this program for that, to just shed light. That's really the first step. But in the long view, we really need to be doing something on a societal scale. And we need to think about how do we support our children?
I'm going to look next at the question of community response and engagement, because sometimes there's the sense that the university is great at doing research and studying a problem. Well, what are they going to do about it? Coming up next on University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with University of the Year. We are talking about the problem of mass incarceration with faculty and graduate students from the School of Human Ecology. With me now is Ethan Pollard, and his approach is through the lens of community. Can you tell me a little bit about what, first of all, before we get to the problem of mass incarceration, tell me what your area, the community studies, what, civil society and community studies, what's the point of that?
I guess the point would be to look at how communities can address large-scale public issues like mass incarceration, what's the community response to that, what's the community outcomes when those around those types of phenomena, and also seeing how to create spaces, programs, policies which support communities in dealing with those types of issues. So it's all about community. It's all about the people.
Do you see yourself sometimes as trying to almost be like a mediator between the research at the university level, the problem in a prison, and then the community at large? Or are you studying what a community can do?
I guess mediator could be a good word to use, but I think more is a better word would be partner. I think we're more about partnering with the community because we both have, as communities and researchers, have different sets of knowledge that are equally important and equally viable in this space, and especially around this issue. So it's more about partnership rather than mediating a relationship for on my end.
Well, let's take a hard look at mass incarceration from your angle, from the kind of studies that you're doing. How do you see mass incarceration and what's needed?
I see mass incarceration as probably the biggest issue that's affecting our country right now. I think, you know, Wisconsin is an exemplar of that, and the fact that it has the most extreme racial disparities in incarceration, which create community-wide problems that are seen outside of the issue, but really are totally related. So in Wisconsin, we have 12.8% of the individuals, African Americans, behind bars who are working age, right? So we have that going on, and then that's 32% higher than the next state below us, which is Oklahoma. So this is the starkest area for disparities in incarceration. Also, we have Milwaukee, which is the most segregated metropolitan area in the country. Two-thirds of the incarcerated population that comes from Milwaukee County comes from 6 zip codes within that county.
I think most people are shocked when they learn how bad a record Wisconsin has in terms of racially disproportionate incarceration, because we would expect to find it maybe in Mississippi or Alabama or something like that. But any thought on why? As you've been looking into the problem of mass incarceration in Wisconsin and so on, any thoughts on why Wisconsin has such a dreadful record?
I think it's primarily because of the socioeconomic and racial segregation that is exemplified in the state. So that is just extreme here. When you go to Mississippi, when you go to Georgia, when you go to Alabama, there's not that kind of racial segregation, actually. And that's a huge misconception that I've learned that folks in the Midwest actually have about the South.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as racially segregated and not as socioeconomically segregated. As I said, we have in Wisconsin, Milwaukee County, the most segregated, racially segregated metropolitan area in the country. And when you have that happening, and literally all of the net job growth is happening in the suburbs, that creates a huge issue for people that are coming out of being incarcerated, or just, as we mentioned earlier, families who are trying to work through those troubles within those counties. Yeah.
I've also seen really bad statistics here in Wisconsin for the educational achievement gap between Black and white students. And I'm assuming there's a link there, that there's a link between dropping out of high school and getting into the criminal justice system.
Yeah, there's a huge link there, but I think we kind of make it, there's a superficial link. So it's like the people kind of frame it as you drop out and then you're more likely to be incarcerated. No, there's a whole list of things that go on beyond that that lead to you being dropping out of high school and then being incarcerated. As we talked about, recidivism, parents being incarcerated and things like that, all of that plays into the mix. And then when you're in an environment and in a community that has, where two-thirds of the people who are incarcerated come from that environment, you know, there's no real other outcome for you to have when the environment is over-policed, when all of your family members are incarcerated. It becomes a normality for you, and in a sense that a lot of people in the state really don't have to think about. And so when you have those communities that are segregated from other places in the state, you don't you don't have to drive through them at being a privileged person, being someone at the university, being an upper middle class white person in the state. You don't have to drive through those zip codes in Milwaukee County. You don't have to drive through the South Side necessarily in Madison. And then when people go to prison, as we talked about earlier, because they're often in rural counties, mm-hmm. They're seen as they're not. It's easy to disassociate that with those people. They're not there. They're gone.
It's almost the way they used to have like leper colonies where you'd take people and you put them on an island or you'd ship them off somewhere mm-hmm. where they're out of sight and then cut off from anyone who cared about them.
Yeah.
Within your own background, what is it that sort of led you to care about this topic and to bring the lens of a school of human ecology to bear on it?
I think my background being I'm a person that has been incarcerated before. I have family members that are incarcerated currently. And so it's almost self-preservation in dealing with this issue in a sense. But at the same time, I think just feeling coming to the Midwest and feeling this this air that's here around the issue, this extreme disparities that people experience here, it touches you. So you have to mm-hmm. do something about it. So when you see folks, so I've been here at the university for 2 years, and of people that I've met here, black people that I met that don't go to the university, I don't know anyone that's not been incarcerated.
Right.
So
it sort of fits that profile of Wisconsin.
Absolutely. So I think that's my interest. So I guess it's more of a personal interest, but at the same time, I recognize it's a national, it's an issue that's nationwide, and systems change is, I think, the key to fixing the issues. And we talked earlier about intent and all these types of things, whether it's corrections or rehabilitation, things like that. I think that's the conversation we need to be having. What is the intent of this criminal justice system? Is it to punish people, or is it to support them when we as a society have failed them and build them back up to become members of the society that we've created and said they can't really be a part of? So
when we were talking about families and children just a few minutes ago with Cynthia, she mentioned the Sesame Street packet for mm-hmm. children who have parents that are incarcerated. Within this area of sort of the community resources to help someone who is getting out of prison so they don't go back right back in, you know, I've worked with those from the Madison Urban Ministry and, you know, Voices Beyond Bars and some other mm-hmm. places like that. What have you seen, or what have you sort of not seen, that you think should be there in the community to help address this problem?
What I have not seen is, I want to really highlight mental health support, counseling. That's not really available. So at the university, even here, so I'll talk about it in this context. If you have a legal issue that you try to go to a counselor and seek some kind of support for, you get turned away because actually they can't impede on the legal process. So you can't go to university counseling and say, hey, I've been incarcerated, or I had a run-in with the police. I need to talk to someone about that. So then there's the stigma around mental health support that's not addressed. I think anecdotally I've heard that Wisconsin, from the DOC, that the jail system here, the prison system, has the best mental health facilities in the state, which is troubling to hear from a DOC worker to think that. But there's really no support in the community for those type of mental health support. So, and also in a vein, so if you're getting that support, who do you go to? There's very few clinics, actually. I know of one here that primarily sees African Americans, who are obviously most impacted by this mm-hmm. issue. So we really got to think about all of those kind of pieces. But I think just the basic stuff goes with supporting someone that is coming back home, housing, job support,
And jobs are difficult to get if you have a criminal background.
Absolutely. So we have CCAP here, which is an open public record. So anyone can look up what's happened to you, even if you've just had a traffic ticket, mm-hmm. or even if it was resolved, you can see step by step what happened in someone's case. And then we also have checking the box for felonies and things like that. So it truly impedes people from getting support, getting jobs, and being able to come back. So then it's kind of hard to challenge that person to make a lifestyle change when you've made it incredibly challenging for them to reenter society.
We've been looking at mass incarceration from three different graduate students who are coming from different, I guess, centers or departments within the School of Human Ecology. Mary Beth, I'm going to throw it back to you as the director of the Centers of Excellence for the School of Human Ecology. Listening to your three wonderful graduate students here, what else would you add in terms of what – I think even the phrase human ecology, people are not sure what that means.
Sure, sure. Well, I mean, I think the basic way to understand human ecology is kind of parsing out those two words. So we're human beings living on this planet. And if you think about the term ecology, the environment in which we live, and you put those two things together, I think the premise of all of our research and work is really examining what are the factors in that ecology and what implications does that ecology have for human well-being and our effect on the environment around us. And all of our different departments, even though they seem disparate in some ways, from design to human development to community organizing, that really is the common lens among them all. And more we're seeing integration among our different disciplinary areas and with other partners on campus. And so I think looking at mass incarceration and hearing from these three voices, each of which come from individuals who are coming up in our academic context, looking at specific disciplines, you can see the way that these things kind of can overlap. And when I think about the way that Joy talks about the intention behind space, and I think about the work that some of our people are doing about inclusive design. You know, we've seen examples where in the United States where juveniles in homeless shelters or delinquency settings have actually been engaged to help design their space. And you think in a visionary way about if we're really going to be real about what these facilities are for, rehabilitation or corrections or the security of the society or what have you, if we really truly engage in that discussion about what are these facilities for, and then we look at design with that intention in mind, we might see a really different outcome. I had the privilege of getting to tour some facilities in Spain, in Argentina, and it was really shocking, and I wasn't prepared for how differently they looked than the high-security prisons I had seen here in the United States and in Wisconsin. They felt like livable environments as opposed to the ones here, which really are stark. I think every person should have to go to a high-security prison here because it's an environment that's almost incomprehensible unless you've seen it. So thinking of architecture and design, you might not link that to human development or human psychology, but I think those connections have been illuminated here today. And then you connect that to Cynthia's commentary on children and the idea of a child going into that environment and trying to retain some kind of attachment or relationship with their parent through this what should be a temporary part of their life together. And, of course, the human development and family studies side just, I think, also really underscores the way this has such a cyclical effect. A small child whose parent is incarcerated, even for a short time, we know that has an impact on their long-term lifespan. And Ethan has commented astutely on the way that it may be that they drop out of high school, but that is not necessarily the cause then for criminal behavior. It's more about these connected factors that we see in our human ecology among poverty, the types of environment you live in and what you see around you and what opportunities you see around you. I come also from a background of working in a nonprofit organization that talked a lot about disproportionate contact with the system. And so if you think about the human ecology of neighborhoods where 2/3 of the adults have a correctional stint, then they have to come back into that same neighborhood or community with a correctional officer monitoring them, their parole. Those neighborhoods are thought of as high crime neighborhoods, so the police are in those neighborhoods more often. The children are suffering with the circumstances we've talked about. There is such a cyclical aspect to the human ecology around this issue. And again, the connections among the space, the family, and the lifespan, and the way that communities look and feel when this cycle continues, it's all connected, and it is a broad issue that we're going to have to be really creative to address.
Sometimes when we listen to all the, you know, description of a problem, it gets inside of us and we want to know, well, what can we do about it? Anything you'd like to add there as we close?
Well, I think Ethan has some commentary on this that will be more informed than mine. But I know one thing we've talked about in the weeks leading up to this show is the way that the folks that are most impacted by this issue, that really understand it, that are not separated from it on a personal level, that have seen it with their own eyes and felt its impact, are often at a truly dramatic disadvantage to take community action around the issue. Mm. And that there is hope, I hope Ethan will agree with me, in partnerships among those that are privileged enough not to be facing these issues personally with those that understand the issue.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, that the people who are often most impacted by the issue are not provided with this capital to organize and address the issue. So, in Madison, you see the majority of folks who organize to address mass incarceration in organizing groups and initiatives are primarily upper middle class white people who aren't directly impacted by the issue. So it's like what often that question comes up, what can we do to help and support folks who have been impacted? Well, what you can do is create space. You can build relationships with legislators and the folks that have been impacted. You can provide financial support, provide housing, provide all those types of things, which often kind of people don't look to do initially. I think a lot of people the action that takes place here is kind of behind the scenes, and the wins that have been made have been attributed to organizing groups that aren't necessarily those that are most impacted. But thankfully now we have groups in the state who are ex-prisoners organizing against this issue. So I think what can folks do? Recognize, one, learn about the issue, recognize what's happening, and be honest about how it's taking place, and what community features lend themselves to this issue happening. For example, the extreme racial segregation that takes place in Madison on the south and north side. So I think that Mary Beth touched on it pretty well, but I think creating space and building relationships, relational power to address the issue is the most important way to do it.
Yeah. And I would think getting the information out to people.
Absolutely.
You know, because I think some of these numbers are not widely known. Some of the extent of the problem maybe people are not aware of. Hmm. And I thank all four of you for getting the information out through this University of the Air program about mass incarceration as seen through the lens of the School of Human Ecology. My guests have been Mary Beth Collins, along with three graduate students. We have heard from Joy Huntington, Cynthia Burnson, and Ethan Pollard. Thanks to all of you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. I'm Emily Auerbach, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.